Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to talk about working up a sweat that can protect men from lethal prostate cancer, University of California, San Francisco. And couples who have sex weekly are the happiest, University of Toronto. And how dried plums can impact colon cancer, Texas A&M University. And also, ashwagandha root extract shows support nutrition potential. Well, that's important. Plus a lot more in health and healing. Then we're going to have a commentary from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, Apocalyptic Capitalism. We're also going to look at the public health segments, including how Dr. Richard Pan, he was the sponsor of SB 277, the mandatory vaccine bill in California, he says water is more toxic than mercury, by Laura Hayes. Really? And scientists are warning about extreme weather, Tim Radford from Climate News Network. And also, Exxon's agricultural power is causing havoc in Africa. I'll tell you about that. Plus, we have some audio clips today I think you'll find of interest in a wide variety of topics. We're going to talk about how there's a message from Anonymous, a warning to African Americans. If you value your life, think about what's going on. You think everything is okay, but really don't know? Well, it gets real out there, Anonymous sharing a message. Also, some police have been systematically planting drugs on blacks for decades in one community. We'll share the latest on that. We've all seen the word natural on packages everywhere. And I want to show you a clip. And for those of you who can see it, it's funny. Those of you who can hear it, you'll appreciate it. It's just about 2 minutes about what's natural. Also, a 12-year-old child reveals one of the best-kept secrets in the world. Question, if a 12-year-old child can see it, why can't we? Let's begin. This is about working up a sweat. A study that tracked tens of thousands of midlife and older men for more than 20 years has found that vigorous exercise and other healthy lifestyle habits can cut their chances of developing a lethal type of prostate cancer by up to 68%. Now, while most prostate cancers are clinically indolent, meaning they do not metastasize and are non-life-threatening, a minority of patients are diagnosed with aggressive disease that invades the bone and other organs and is ultimately fatal. And the lead author on this, from Harvard and University of California, San Francisco, found on this variant of prostate cancer is impacted by exercising. So this was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and there were 42,000 males involved in this, and they found that if you engage in lifestyle habits, that you're going to have a healthier prostate, be less likely to have this, especially if you're exercising vigorously and have a lower, what is called BMI, which is body mass index. And if it's under 30, that's good. And if you haven't smoked for 10 years, that's good. If you have a high intake of fatty fish, that's good. Tomatoes, that's good. And get rid of the processed meat. So protect your prostate. Protect it from prostate cancer by giving yourself lots of time to exercise and eat right. I found this interesting, and this is about couples and sex. This is in the University of Toronto. Quote, more sex may not always make you happier, according to new research published in the Society of Personality and Social Psychology. Although more frequent sex is associated with greater happiness, this link was no longer significant at a frequency of more than once a week. Our findings suggest that it's important to maintain an intimate connection with your partner, but you don't need to have sex every day as long as you're maintaining that connection. Now, some previous studies and a plethora of articles and self-help books have claimed that more sex equals more happiness, but this study, based upon a survey of 30,000 Americans collected over 40 years, is the first to find that association is not there after couples report having sex more than once a week on average. And so, the takeaway message: stay close to your partner, share your love and affection, and show that affection. Be creative. But with sex, if you've gotten to where you're having it once a week, that's enough. If you can have it more than once a week, great. If you could add it every day, excellent. But the fact that you don't have it every day or just once a week, don't let the lack of sex make you feel that somehow you're losing it. You can still maintain absolute happiness just once a week. So that's good. Dried plums, according to Texas A&M University and North Carolina University, are good for your colon, especially if you have cancer. Quote, researchers from Texas A&M University, University of North Carolina, have shown a diet containing dried plums can positively affect microbiota, also referred to as gut bacteria, through the colon, helping to reduce the risk of colon cancer. So that's terrific. Quote, through our research, we are able to show that dried plums promote retention of beneficial bacteria through the colon, and by doing so, they may reduce the risk of colon cancer. Well, keep in mind, this audience knows that colon cancer is the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States, when men and women are considered separately, and the second leading cause when the figures are combined. So we'll have about 50,000 deaths this year in the United States. And there's a lot of research showing that the plant-based diet helps prevent that. And fermented foods give your colon the microbiota, the good bacteria that they need. So you have trillions of bacteria in the intestinal tract. And so far, more than 400 individual species have been identified. And previously, research has shown that disruptions to the microbiota are involved in the initiation of intestinal inflammation and recurrence of inflammatory bouts that can promote the development of colon cancer. So, have your plums and reduce your risk of colon cancer. There is an herb. It is very popular in Southeast Asia and in India. It is called ashwagandha, ashwagandha. And the root is now being shown to help with athletic potential. Quote, supplements of ashwagandha root extract may improve muscle strength, muscle size, recovery of your muscles. This is a randomized, prospective, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical study. 8 weeks of supplementing with the Ayurvedic herb in combination with the resistance training program were associated with significantly lower levels of exercise-induced muscle damage, significantly greater levels of estrogen, and a significant greater decrease in body fat compared to placebo. And this was published in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition. And by the way, of all the herbs used in Ayurveda, the ashwagandha is probably, along with curcumin or turmeric, are the two tops. And ashwagandha has been gaining traction in the mainstream U.S. market, with consumers embracing its wide-ranging body health benefits, which including it lowers stress, it improves cognitive function, improves sleep, improves metabolic wellness, therefore everyone who's overweight, pre-diabetic, or diabetic, helps with adrenal exhaustion, helps you overcome it, and now add sports to that. That's terrific. And it's inexpensive and it's safe. Some good research out of Italy from the University of Perugia shows that chocolate Modern consumption of chocolate, quote, may help expectant mothers and their fetuses by reducing stress and providing antioxidants that guard against reproductive disease and pregnancy complications. And this was published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. And once again, it highlights the beneficial effects from chocolate supplementation. And there's no negative effects, only positive benefits. I always suggest having a 2 to 3 ounce piece of chocolate once a day in the late afternoon, and have yourself a natural chocolate. The higher the percentage of natural chocolate, cacao, the healthier it is. There's lots of antioxidants, lots of good things. It can also help reduce blood pressure. And also, we found that female hormone supplements with estrogen and progestin link to breast cancer risk. This is from Boston University, published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, that postmenopausal African-American women who use these synthetic female hormone supplements containing estrogen and progestin, that's what's called combination therapy, are at an increased risk of estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. The study is substantial. It found that overall risk increased by 50%, with greater increases for recent or long-term users. Now, prior epidemiological studies have been based largely in white women. In those studies, use of a combination therapy was associated with an increased risk of estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer, the most commonly occurring breast cancer subtype, which is known to be sensitive to hormone factors. So, women, African-American women in particular, if you're menopausal or postmenopausal, please do not use synthetic hormone replacement therapy. You put your life at risk. And also, there's new research out on the anti-diabetic potential of nettles and walnut leaves. That's right. This is a good study. Why? Because in the United States and throughout the world, rates of diabetic patients continue to rise. We're at pandemic levels in the United States. It is estimated that we have 30 million diabetics, another 60 million who are pre-diabetic, and one half of all adults in the United States today are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. And most are untreated. Yeah, pre-diabetic are untreated. That constitutes a major challenge to the healthcare system, since this chronic condition can lead to very serious long-term health problems. And these problems can include kidney failure, blindness, neuropathy, even amputations due to poor wound healing and circulatory problems. And conventional medicine has tried to treat diabetes with insulin or pills to help control blood sugars, but due to the serious side effects of such medications, their search is on to find natural solutions to help manage diabetes on a day-to-day basis, and to help prevent complications from arising. Well, the recent study is a good one. They were looking at stinging nettle and walnut leaves as a potential source of new diabetic therapies. The enzymes from these plants are just two of the over 400 plant extracts that are being studied worldwide for one special reason. They're able to block the activity of alpha amylase, a substance which allows for digestion of carbohydrates in the stomach and for a corresponding rise in blood sugar levels. There are, in fact, many drugs in the market called alpha amylase inhibitors, which seek to control diabetes in this way. The reason, however, that rare researchers from all over the world are searching for a natural way to do this is because these particular drugs can have serious long-term side effects. This is why so many diabetics are wanting this study. Well, here's what the researchers found. The recent study came out of the University of Medical Science in Bandar Abbas in Iran. And as part of their research, scientists looked at the effects of the extract of both nettles and walnut leaves in to block the activity of the alpha amylase. What they found was that both plant extracts were very effective at blocking this compound. When a dosage of 2 milligrams per milliliter extract of nettle was used, The result was a 60% inhibition of the alpha amylase, while walnut leaf extract at a concentration of 0.4 milligrams per milliliter had the same effect. So that's good, and that's very helpful. Also, from the University of Copenhagen, flaxseed beats probiotics for improving insulin sensitivity and altering microbiota. A study comparing fibrous flaxseed with probiotics has questioned the latter's ability to alter gut microbiota and improve obesity-related metabolic disease. The study saw a large group of obese postmenopausal women given a daily dose of either 10 grams of flaxseed mucilage, which contained about 30% dietary fiber, or a maltodextrin placebo for 6 weeks. And the researchers then looked at the fecal DNA to identify changes in gut microbiota. They sought to explore the theory that obesity-related metabolic disease were accompanied by alterations in a person's gut bacteria and the gene composition. And it was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. The study found that flaxseed mucilage altered 33 of these species, including decreasing 8 species that we didn't want, and which is a good thing. It improved insulin sensitivity, so that's good too. So, eat your flax seeds because you're getting something we didn't know. You're having an improvement in insulin sensitivity, and you're producing more good microbiota. And that's good. And also, for those of you who are taking, which millions of Americans do, the antacid medications, you've seen the commercials where a person goes to eat a pizza and it slaps them in the face, and, oh, but you don't have to worry about that, just take this antacid. The antacid works by turning off the production of hydrochloric acid into the stomach. However, you need the hydrochloric acid in order to break down the food into its most beneficial absorbable component size. Otherwise, the stomach just dumps undigested, partially digested food in the intestine. That's not good. That can cause malabsorption. So then you end up with this acid reflux. And millions upon millions of Americans have it because they eat the wrong food, highly processed food, deep-fried food, high-fat food, animal proteins. All of that is bad. And then you end up with a form of gastroesophageal reflux, also known as heartburn or acid reflux. And then you end up taking the drug. What they found was the drugs you're taking increase your risk of heart attack. So you can trigger a heart attack by taking the medications. This is a study out of Stanford University and Houston Methodist Research Institute. Showed that 16 to 21% increased risk of heart attacks. And these studies were published in the medical journal PLOS and looked at the medical records of almost 3 million patients with a history of taking these antacids. So it's a big study, a good study. And remember, these antacids are a cash cow for the pharmaceutical industry. Go to a healthy plant-based diet, you don't have to worry about that. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
She musters a smile.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now to our environmental segment. First up, we have scientists, according to Tom Radford from Climate News, warning us that extreme weather is upon us and it's going to get worse. According to Tim, new research warns that longer, hotter, and more frequent heat waves than those that killed 55,000 Russians in 2010 or 72,000 in France, Portugal, and Italy, the Netherlands, Germany, and the UK in 2003 will hit Europe. But over the same period, Europe could also begin to get colder as a consequence of a drop in solar activity, and a century-long chill could be on the way, according to a study of long-period climate cycles. And if global warming accelerates and average global ocean temperatures rise by 6 degrees Celsius or more, most of the living, breathing world could, in any case, begin to suffocate. That's according to ominous calculations by a mathematician. At some point, the providers of oxygen would simply begin to perish. And all three uncomfortable projections were published as 30,000 delegates, politicians, observers, pressure groups, and journalists gathered in Paris for the conference there at the UN Summit on Climate Change. And they're trying to forge an agreement that could ultimately limit global warming to a planetary average of 2% or less. That isn't going to happen. And as a geophysicist, Simone Rousseau, and colleagues from the European Union Joint Research Center in Italy report in environmental research letters that they develop a heat wave magnitude index to show this. So what does this mean in lay language, language we can understand? Well, for that, you would have to do two things. Just take a look at what Counterpunch has shown us with neoliberals with chainsaws, rampant deforestation in Peru, and the future of the Amazon. Quote, since the election of President Humala in Peru in 2011, priority has been given to neoliberal policies, free trade agreements, integration into the Pacific market through the Pacific Alliance with Mexico, Colombia, and Chile, and the intent to increase exports in order to promote wealth in the country. It appears, if one takes a look at macroeconomic indicators, that the economic situation in Peru is going very well. The gross domestic product has increased 25% since 2010, with a growth rate around 6%. In the past 5 years, the country's debt has decreased from 25% of gross domestic product to 20%, and inflation remains impressively low at about 3%. And while the economy is on the rise, Peru's economic model is based upon a certain abundance of natural resources. The main exports of Peru are primarily products due to excessive mining and deforestation, leading to many problems for local population and indigenous people. Gold represents around 20% of the country's exports, copper ore around another 18%, and the refined petroleum around 7%, and that's big time, but it's also Peru exports a lot of wood, and hence they're cutting down these trees. So deforestation is big time, and that's where they make a lot of money. And so here's how it works. Peru's forest covers about 67.8 million hectares, or more than half of the land area in Peru. And officially, as claimed by Peruvian Minister of Environment, the goal of government is to achieve zero net deforestation through conservation of 54 million hectare acres of forest on the ground. Situation very different, and it appears that priority may be given to the growth, not the saving of the planet. Now, we've already seen what happens in Brazil. You have a rainforest. The rainforest anywhere in the world and the boreal forest in the northern latitudes, they trap carbon dioxide. They're called carbon sinks. They hold it, just like the ocean floor holds carbon, just like the great frozen areas of Siberia and around the Arctic. It holds the methane gases in, and there's an enormous amount being held in, providing that it doesn't get warmer. If it gets warmer, because you've cut down the trees, therefore you don't have the humidity going in the air, and you don't have a carbon sink anymore, it dries out the land. and then you don't have that carbon being held, it's being released. And so that's just one way it happens. When you start mining for anything and you clear cut a lot of the forest, once again, you're causing a shift. This is in addition to all the other uses, including agriculture, of 70 billion creatures being raised for human consumption. And that methane is up to 22 times more powerful in global warming than is carbon dioxide. And then you have all of the methane that is trapped, an enormous amount that is trapped in the frozen tundras, in the permafrost, and at the colder depths of the ocean. You warm the ocean, it starts to warm up, and it's not trapped, it's released. We've already seen huge, almost like craters that you would see in a volcano coming in Siberia. Turns out those were methane blasts. Huge amounts of pressure underneath, and boom, it explodes, and the land comes up for the size of a football field or larger around it. Methane. Now, they're now seeing thousands of those methane bubbles, pockets coming up in the Arctic. So that's one way we end up increasing the planet. Another way it comes, like when Exxon of agriculture wields power to block real climate solutions. This is from Common Dreams and from Andrea Germanos. Quote, members of Abarno Organic Food Project in their organic chili farm in Ghana. It shows a picture of two women standing in the middle of a chili pepper farm. Fertilizer companies from the Exxon of Agriculture are blocking beneficial climate policies with their massive lobbying power. The publication by Grain, an international nonprofit organization that advocates for locally controlled biodiversity, food-based systems, describes how the fertilizer industry, whose products the group says are responsible for up to 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions, has joined forces with major corporations like Walmart in order to cast itself as a purveyor of climate-smart policies while protecting its interest. Yet these so-called climate-smart policies that rely on the industry's products are anything but. Take nitrogen fertilizers. They take a lot of energy to produce, and they're increasingly relying on fracking by wells for that production. The damage continues once they're applied to fields. Quote, the International Panel on Climate Change estimates that for every 100 kilograms of nitrogen fertilizer applied to the soil, 1 kilogram ends up in the atmosphere as nitrogen oxide, a gas that is 300 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas and is the world's most significant ozone-depleting substance. In 2014, this was equivalent to the average annual emissions of 72 million cars driven in the United States, about a third of the U.S. fleet of cars and trucks. Quote, fertilizer companies like Yara of Norway are the Exxons of agriculture, and they fuel a model of agriculture that is destroying the planet, and they're doing everything in their power to block action on climate change that would injure their profits. So, here we have people throughout Africa and other countries who are starting to grow locally sustainable crops organically. They're actually helping with global warming instead of using artificial fertilizers, monocrops like soybeans or corn that destroy the topsoil and put nitrogen into the oxide into the environment. And yet the UN and Bono and Bill Gates and all these other personalities, they support the big corporate model of agriculture in Africa and other countries. And they're able to influence their foundations, their grants, the politicians, and the landowners. So we should be returning to the land organically and sustainably. Instead, equity partnerships, hedge funds are buying enormous tracts of land around the world because they're betting upon the cost of food being sky high. After all, you hear a lot about global warming and food production. What you don't hear is any discussion about the population growing. And that's unfortunate because the world cannot support the amount of people with our existing systems. We would have to change the systems to support more people on the planet. We already have over 1.5 billion of the 7+ billion people on the planet who are food insecure. They're in areas where it's drought. It's going to get worse. In the United States, we never, growing up as a baby boomer, we never thought of droughts in the United States. We thought only of abundance. We exported our grains and fruits and vegetables around the world. Now we have California drought forever. Oklahoma, Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Nevada, South Dakota, Idaho, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, drought. So ours is spreading. It's going to get worse, not better. And therefore, a lot of people in the future are going to be having to pay a lot of money for food because we're going to be able to grow less of it. So that's how we end up in the mess we're in. Now, the charade of the 21st United Nations Climate Summit, according to Chris Hedges, will end as past climate summits have ended. What? With lofty rhetoric and ineffectual cosmetic reforms. Since the first summit more than 20 years ago, carbon dioxide emissions have soared, placing faith in our political and economic elites who have mastered the arts of duplicity and propaganda on behalf of corporate power. And this is the triumph of hope over experience. There are only a few ways left to deal honestly with climate change. Sustained civil disobedience that disrupts the machinery of exploitation, preparing for the inevitable dislocations and catastrophes that will come from irreversible rising temperatures, and cutting our personal carbon footprint, which means drastically reducing your consumption, particularly of animal products. Our civilization, Dr. Richard Oppenlander, writes in Food Choices and Sustainability, quote, displays a curious instinct when confronted with a problem related to overconsumption. We simply find a way to produce more of what it is we're consuming instead of limiting or stopping that consumption, end quote. Now, the global elites have no intention of interfering with profits or ending government subsidies for the fossil fuel industry and the extraction industries. They will not curtail extraction or impose hefty carbon taxes to keep fossil fuels in the ground. They will not limit the overconsumption that is the engine of global capitalism. They act as if the greatest contributor of greenhouse gases, the animal agricultural industry, simply doesn't exist. They siphon off trillions of dollars and employ scientific and technological expertise that should be directed towards preparing for environmental catastrophe and investing in renewable energy. Instead, they wage endless wars in the Middle East. What they airily hold out as a distant solution to the crisis, wind turbines or solar panels, is, as the scientist James Lovelock says, the equivalent of 18th century doctors attempting to cure serious disease with leeches mercury. And as the elites mouth platitudes about saving the climate, they are shoving still another trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, down our throats. The TPP permits corporations to ignore non-binding climate accords made at conferences such as the one in Paris, and it allows them in secret trade tribunals to defy environmental regulations imposed by individual states. New technology, fracking and fuel-efficient vehicles or genetically modified food, is not about curbing overconsumption or conserving resources. It's about ensuring that consumption continues at unsustainable levels. Technological innovation, employed to build systems of greater and greater complexity, has fragmented society into cadres of specialists. The expertise of each of these specialists is limited to a small section of the elaborate technological and scientific and bureaucratic machinery that drives corporate capitalism forward. Much as is the in the specialized bureaucracy machinery that defined the genocide carried out by the Nazis. These technocrats are part of the massive, unthinking hive that makes any system work, even a system of death. They lack the intellectual and moral capacity to question the doomsday machine spawned by global capitalism and they are in control. Civilizations careening towards collapse create ever more complex structures and more intricate specialization to exploit diminishing resources. But eventually the resources are simply destroyed or exhausted. The systems and technologies designed to exploit these resources become useless. Economists call such a phenomena the Jevons paradox. The result is systems collapse. Now, in the wake of collapses, as evidenced through history, societies fragment politically, culturally, and socially. They become failed states, bleak and desolate outposts where law and order break down, and there is a mad and often violent scramble for the basic necessities of life. In effect, barbarism reigns. Only the strong survive, the weak are victimized, robbed, and killed. That's what the anthropologist Joseph Tainter writes in The Collapse of Complex Societies. He says, there is fighting for food and fuel. Whatever central authority remains lacks the resources to reimpose order. Bands of pitiful, maimed survivors scavenge among the ruins of grandeur. Grass grows in the streets. There's no high goal rather than survival. The elites trained in business schools and managerial programs not to solve real problems but to maintain at any cost the systems of global capitalism profit personally from the assault. They amass inconceivable sums of wealth while their victims, the underclasses around the globe, are thrust into increasing distress from global warming, poverty, and societal breakdown. The apparatus of government seized by this corporate cabal is hostile to genuine change. It passes laws, as it did in Denton, Texas, after residents voted to outlaw fracking in their city to overturn the ability of local communities to control their own resources. It persecutes dissidents, along with the environmental and animal rights activists who try to halt the insanity. The elites don't work for us. They don't work for the planet. They orchestrate the Gaia side, and they're well paid for it. The Anthropocene Age, the age of humans, which has caused mass extinctions of plants and animal species, and the pollution of the soil and the air and the oceans, it's now. The pace of destruction is accelerating. Climate scientists say that sea levels, for example, are rising three times faster than predicted, and the Arctic ice is vanishing at rates that were unforeseen. Quote, if carbon dioxide concentrations reach 500 parts per million, writes Clive Hamilton in Requiem for a Species, after which emissions fell to zero, the global temperature would continue to rise for at least another century. We already passed 400 parts per million, a figure not seen on Earth, for 3 to 5 million years. We're on track to reach at least 550 parts per million. The breakdown of the planet, many predict, will be nonlinear, meaning that various systems that sustain life, as Tainter chronicles in his study of collapsed civilizations, will disintegrate simultaneously. The infrastructures that distribute food, supply our energy, ensure our security, produce and transport our baffling array of products, and maintain law and order will crumble all at once. It won't be much fun. Soaring temperatures, submerged island states, coastal cities, mass migrations, species extinction, monster storms, droughts, famines, declining crop yields, and a security and surveillance apparatus, along with militarized police that will employ harsher and harsher methods to cope with the chaos. We have to let go of our relentless positivism, our absurd mania for hope, and face the bleakness of reality before us. To resist means to acknowledge that we are living in a world already heavily damaged by global warming. It means refusing to participate in the destruction of the planet. It means non-cooperation with authority. It means defying in every way possible consumer capitalism, militarism, and imperialism. It means adjusting our lifestyle, including what we eat, to thwart the forces bent upon our annihilation. The animal agricultural industry has, in a staggering act of near total censorship, managed to stifle public discussion about the industry's complicity and global warming. It is barely mentioned in climate summits. Yet livestock and their byproducts, yes, Kip Anderson and Keegan Kahn point out in their book, The Sustainability Secret, and their documentary, Cowspiracy, account for at least 32,000 million tons of carbon dioxide per year, or 51% of all worldwide greenhouse gas emissions. Methane and nitrous oxide are rarely mentioned in climate talks, although those two greenhouse gases are, as the authors point out, respectively 86 times and 296 times more destructive than carbon dioxide. Cattle worldwide, they write, produce 150 billion gallons of methane daily, and 65% of the nitrous oxide produced by human-related activities is caused by the animal agricultural industry. Water used in fracking, they write, ranges from 70 billion to 140 billion gallons annually. Animal agriculture water consumption, the book notes, ranges from 34 to 66 trillion gallons annually. Raising animals for human consumption takes up 45% of the planet's land, 91% of the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest, and up to 80% of the global rainforest loss are caused by clearing land for the grazing of livestock and growing feed crops for meat and dairy animals. As more and more rainforest disappears, the planet loses one of its primary means to safely sequester carbon dioxide. The animal agricultural industry is, as Anderson and Kahn write, also a principal cause of species extinction and the creation of more than 95,000 square miles of nitrogen-flooded dead zones in the oceans. A person who eats a vegan diet, they point out, a diet free of meat, eggs, and dairy, saves 1,100 gallons of water, 45 pounds of grain, 30 square feet of forest land, and 20 pounds of CO2 equivalent, and one's animal life every day. The animal agriculture industry has pushed through ag-gag laws in many states that criminalize protests, critiques of the industry, and whistleblowing that attempts to bring the public's attention to the staggering destruction wrought on the environment by the business of raising 70 billion land animals every year worldwide to be exploited and consumed by humans. And they have done so, I presume, because defying the animal agriculture industry is as easy as deciding not to put animal products, which have tremendous scientifically proven health risks, into your mouth. In conclusion, we have little time left. Those who are despoiling the earth do so for personal gain, believing they can use their privilege to escape the fate that will befall the human species. We may not be able to stop the assault, but we can refuse to allow it. The idols of power and greed, as the biblical prophets warned us, threaten the doom of the human race. And if any of you saw the movie, Saving the Planet One Bite at a Time, then you know that by going vegan to a healthy plant-based diet, you're doing your part to save the planet. As far as Paris is go in this conference, well, forget about it. Nothing is mandated. It's all voluntary. That means that it's just a dog and pony show. The government negotiations in Paris are looking at banal details for how and when countries should commit to improving their voluntary pledges. And nothing good will come from it. Nothing. Not a single thing. It is all a game. They have done nothing in the last two decades at all the conferences and all the promises, because nobody wants to be held accountable and held accountable in their industries or to decrease industries who are polluting. Nobody wants to give up the power, the money of control over something that enriches them as it destroys the earth. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see,
Welcome back, everyone. To close out our show today, I'm going to play an audio clip from Brandy Vaughn, a former sales rep for Merck & Company, a vaccine maker. And in this audio clip, she details how vaccine companies are using vaccines as a vehicle for massive profit and not public health. And a lack of true safety research of vaccines combined with the known adverse reactions to vaccines helped Brandy decide to never vaccinate her own child. She recently launched a public awareness billboard campaign about vaccine risk, and you can learn more at learntherisk.org. Now let's listen to Brandy.
My first involvement with the pharmaceutical industry was as a pharmaceutical sales rep for Merck, back when Vioxx was on the market. And when I used to rep Vioxx for Merck, and when it came out that Merck had falsified safety data, and Vioxx actually had twice the increase in heart attacks and strokes, people taking it, it really made me realize that there was a lot of corruption behind the scenes, and that just because something is on the market, a drug is on the market, doesn't mean it's safe. So after working for Merck, I was pretty disillusioned over the whole scandal, and I lived in Europe for 8 years, and I had my son over there, and I brought him back vaccine-free at 6 months to San Francisco. And when I went to a well visit, they pushed for vaccines. And at that point, I hadn't done a lot of research in it, but I knew enough not to trust pharmaceutical drugs. And I asked to see a vaccine insert. And the doctor got very upset at me and claimed I didn't trust him. And he stormed out of the room. And the nurse let me know that I wasn't really welcome back in that clinic anymore. And that was a huge red flag for me, knowing what I knew from being a pharmaceutical sales rep before. And I started to do my research into vaccines and the ingredients and the flawed safety data. And what came to light was many things, but one of them was that aluminum is the main adjuvant in vaccines, in childhood vaccines. And I had experience with that, with researching that and the toxicity of aluminum, because my grandmother had breast cancer and the doctor biopsied her tissues and there were high levels of aluminum. And he told us that she needed to get off traditional deodorant and that the aluminum in there was linked to breast cancer. It was carcinogenic. So that was a big red flag for me when I realized those were in childhood vaccines, and I couldn't believe it, actually. And then I started to do more and more research, and I realized that the U.S. gives twice as many vaccines on the childhood schedule than most developed countries. And the real health crisis is the fact that our kids are sicker than any other country in the developed world. And this is despite spending more per capita on healthcare. So we have highest rates of SIDS, asthma, food allergies, ADHD, childhood leukemia, diabetes, type 1. And this, to me, was the true health crisis. So the more I dug into this, what I realized was vaccines are not for public health. It's really about profit, pharmaceutical company profit. And the thing about vaccines is that you don't have to do the same rigorous safety studies as you do for other pharmaceutical drugs, because they're classified as a public health measure versus a pharma drug. So for vaccines, they have a totally different type of safety study. It's very short in duration. It's not double-blind, placebo-based, which is the gold standard for pharmaceutical drugs. And vaccines aren't held to the same rigorous safety studies. So if you look into them, it's very easy to manipulate the data and present that as something that's safe. But if you really look into the studies and look into the toxicity of the adjuvants and the additives, you realize that the safety studies are not proving safety at all. In fact, there are a lot of studies on the other side showing that a lot of the additives in vaccines are very toxic, especially to children who have very immature immune systems. So as I dug more into the safety studies and saw how flawed they were, it really raised a red flag for me. And my son is now 4 and a half, and he's vaccine free. And I really got motivated to get more into this fight when I realized the mandatory vaccination bills that were sweeping the country, over 138 states. And it's clear to me that it's definitely about profit over public health. And one of the things that I know is that a lot of pharmaceutical companies have lost blockbuster drugs. They've lost their patent recently in the last few years. So they're looking to make up their profit. And vaccines, because they have less safety studies, less rigorous, so therefore a lot less expensive to do and a lot less hurdles to get onto the market, coupled with the fact that pharmaceutical companies don't have any liability for vaccines. In fact, the only product in the U.S. that has no liability, so you cannot sue them if there's injury or death. So you put those two things together, and what you have is vaccines as a pharmaceutical drug with the highest profit margin available. And if you make those mandatory and you keep increasing the schedule, it's basically using our children to profit off of. And the pharmaceutical company is using vaccines as a new driver for profit. And this is really what's behind the mandatory vaccination bills. So one of the things that I'm often asked is, why do we not hear about this if, you know, this is true? And one of the things that I've found out in my research is that the U.S. is one of only two countries in the world that allow pharmaceutical companies to advertise directly to consumers. And I'm sure we've all seen the media and the advertisements for the pharmaceutical drugs. And what happens there is that it allows pharmaceutical companies to basically dictate what is shown to the media. Because when you give the media 30 to 40% of their advertising dollars, you basically control what they say. And there have been a lot of journalists and stories that have been censored, including the CDC whistleblower that came out in the end of 2014, basically saying that the CDC has covered up data showing that the MMR vaccine does, in fact, cause neurological damage, aka autism. And recently, there have been a lot of stories of different countries suing vaccine makers for injury and death, and even pulling vaccines off of the schedule, like Gardasil in Japan and Prevnar in China, rotavirus vaccine in France. And Spain has a lawsuit against Merck for Gardasil as well. Pharmaceutical companies spend $18 billion annually marketing directly to consumers, so through mainstream media. Yet they spend six times that marketing to doctors through healthcare, health insurance plans, through educational conferences, through materials, through studies that are published in medical journals, all of these types of things. And what it really comes down to is that we have vaccines that have no liability for the manufacturers, very little safety data to say that they are safe and effective, and we have a lot of marketing going out there. So we have a very broken system. Our vaccine system in the U.S. is broken. And we cannot mandate something when there are so many unanswered questions and so many things that are going on behind the scenes that people aren't aware of, including vaccine ingredients. Like when the pediatrician didn't want to show me the vaccine insert, well, there's good reason for that. There's aluminum, formaldehyde, fetal cells, animal cells. There are a lot of things in there that other countries, A, ban from being ingested and therefore have vaccines that don't include these ingredients, and B, have unknown consequences that we have no data on right now. And so it's basically playing Russian roulette with our children. And, you know, pharma is saying, oh, it's all about public health and public safety. And I'm saying, hey, why don't we have more data on what this really will do, long-term studies on what this is doing in, you know, inside of our bodies and to our children? Because right now we have the sickest children in the developed world. Something is going on here. It's probably not just vaccines. It's a chemical cocktail of pesticides and pollutants in our water and air. But vaccines are often a trigger because genetically we need a trigger to express these kinds of diseases and issues that we have. And vaccines are often what does that because the chemicals are injected into our bloodstream, and so they don't go through a lot of the body's natural detox process. They go straight to the brain through the past the blood-brain barrier. And we need to ask these difficult questions. And until we have more information, we absolutely cannot mandate vaccines. There has to be a choice. If there's a risk, there has to be a choice.
I just want to mention that we have part one and part two of uncovering the cover-up on vaccines safety and then voodoo science, the efficacy of vaccine. They're both at our website, both my Facebook and prn.fm and orgarynall.com. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's show. Have a nice day, everyone.